This is our last class, and so therefore, speak now or forever hold your peace. And I have questions, another one of which was, Bob, what was it? What was the question that I wanted to ask him? Can you remember? Oh, yes. When an astral family invites someone to be born, are they inviting them to die on this side? Do you get born in an astral family from other parts of the astral world? Or when somebody's, and I was sort of saying to Bob, or is it like there's some kind of like an astral bulletin board? These souls coming up for adoption, you know? Breathing their last in the world, the planet Earth, you know? Or do you just like go to an astral family for a while and then you get adopted somewhere else? And who's the mommy and who's the daddy? I mean, like, how does the whole thing work? I got
sometimes
very curious.
You're going back and forth between the astral and the causal world.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're going back and forth between the astral and the physical world.
Yeah, it's true.
Sometimes you're going intra-astral.
So it seems.
Remember that book that you recommended and then Swami said it wasn't that great, but it was interesting that you go to a certain little group that you've been with forever or something?
Well, Swami negated that whole book, so it was Journey of Souls, which I thought was just really terrific. I recommended it to everyone, and then I gave it to Swami, and Swami went. Yeah, and so I just kind of slunk off with an embarrassed silence and haven't referred to it since and hoped the whole subject would die. He said it was far too, his phrase was, it was far too psychological. Everybody's just sitting around thinking about things and talking about them as if that would actually solve problems. He says that's not how it really works. So, too bad, folks. I really like that book. He gave me a really hard time about that book for many weeks. I'd actually blotted it out until you brought it up just now.
Sorry.
He would take lots of opportunities to remind me of how much he disliked that book. So I don't know what the lesson was. I just took it cheerfully. And then still secretly said, I really liked it. I thought it was really good. So.
Well, I do ask a serious question on that book, though, because I liked it a lot myself. But what I wonder, and then clarification from Swami, is obviously all of us that meditate a lot will be in a much different vibration. As far as my assumption is we'll be in a state where we'll basically be able to meditate a lot and we won't have to worry about going to work and things like that. And we won't be sitting there psychologically doing it. But what I wonder, as for souls that don't meditate at all, that basically are on a very material plane, I wonder if those individuals...
Swamiji says, nobody learns by just sitting around and talking.
Right, but is that what happens to what people are on a...
Nobody learns by sitting around and talking. Therefore, a system that's based on people coming around and sitting around and talking is not going to advance them low, high, anything. In fact, even less people who are hooked into their delusions, even less can you talk things out. That's why Master, when he was guiding people... He did not talk a lot. He would give you a hint and then he would send you off to have an experience until your own experience aligned you sufficiently to understand what little bit he'd said. The whole talk theory of personal transformation is a very modern one. That was what Swamiji was attacking primarily in that book.
Right, but that wasn't the question. The question is people, and here's the question, if people that don't meditate in the astral state, what did they do? Because they're not going to be...
They're not conscious. That's what Sri Yukteswar says. Many people, if you don't have the subtlety to understand consciousness without sensory experience, you're simply not conscious. You dream. And you don't really wake up again until you have a physical body. And that's also why, on another more subtle level, see, people like us have always had this sense that it could be better than it is here. There's just like this feeling that, you know, there's something like a little out of alignment here, something it could be better. Even from children we've had that feeling. And when we have the opportunity to create environments, we create environments that look like this. You know, we just try to make it ethereal. We might try to make it translucent in some way or another. Beautiful, harmonious. Like, that's our concept of what the world is supposed to look like. And we conceive of these things and then are constantly trying to create beauty because we have these very strong memories of that's the way things are. But there are a lot of people who just take this world as the world. You know, you see them and you talk to them. This is just the way things are. It doesn't even occur to them that there's another reality. And they don't necessarily, it's not even that they like it or dislike it, they just don't have a frame of reference for thinking of an alternative. And we often joke about the people who lived in our apartment complex before we did. You know, they were from some lower astral world because the apartments were dark anyway, and then all the furniture was brown and the carpets were brown and they kept the curtains drawn. It's like their image of what you did when you would create something was to just make it really dark. And you know, we were desperate to get in there and just, we were amazed that we could make the same room so different by just changing our vibrations. So such people, when they go to the astral world and things are subtle and made of light, they just like, nothing happens. They open their eyes and they don't see it. So they just don't open their eyes. They're just in what, I think it's described in here, it's been described elsewhere as kind of a gray dream. You know, it's kind of a gray dream, so they don't have, they come back to this world, they don't have strong memories of that world. And they don't have also, I mean, see, all the different things that we have which make us so impatient with this world, where we just feel it can be done better, where we can imagine it, and we try to make art and music and so on, so because we remember it being really perfectly beautiful. Swami went so far as to say that our whole, all the Ananda communities and the energy of building them is an astral memory. He said, we've had astral communities together, and that's why it's so easy for us to make a community. You know, you see some people come together. Years ago, Swami will tell this story like it was 3 or 4 years ago. It was probably like 24 years ago now or something like that. I knew David. It was about 22 years ago. I was invited up to represent Ananda at a conference in Oregon on communities. And I mean, I never really thought about this, what I'm about to say, until just now. But there were two things that were interesting. One was that nobody cared at all about Ananda. This is like a big conference on communities, and nobody cared. I had this whole slideshow. We were doing this incredible thing. Almost nobody was doing anything except us and Findhorn. Nobody would listen to me at all. I finally said to Peter Caddy, who was the founder of Findhorn and was still alive then, obviously, because I spoke to him, I said, Peter, why don't they care about us? Why are they so interested in you? Why don't they care about us? And he said, well, Findhorn promises them heaven on earth. He said, and you promised them that they can transcend earth and go to heaven. He said, nobody's really interested. I thought it was very astute. It was exactly true. We said, you're going to have to repudiate this and go somewhere else. But they couldn't see me. They just really couldn't see me. I never got to make any presentations. But also, and this is the part I was going to comment on, you know, we had this one whole evening devoted to these 8 people who had bought some land and were going to make a community on it. And they were talking about these incredibly laborious processes that they were going to go through, you know, to decide where the roads were going to go or the buildings were going to go. And I just realized now, I mean, they've never been a community before. So in order to decide anything, they had to just like do all this stuff. And it would take them years, if they ever did it at all, to just decide perfectly where the road should go with all of this elaborate. People often ask us at Ananda, how do you do things? And we just sort of say, well, we just sort of do, you know, we just kind of decide. And it just works because we're in tune with each other. And we're in tune with each other for many, many lifetimes. And I think also being in the astral world where the attunement was just understood. There was just a shared vision. And we kind of just go forward and manifest it. And we all came down together, Swamiji said, to manifest it again. And, you know, it's gotten even more subtle than that because, you know, each of our different colonies has a kind of core group of its own little form. There used to be just one group. But now we've made all these subsequent little karmic families in all these various places of people who were born to do that, in tune with that particular one. Not necessarily forever, but just part of making that one happen. And still, what's been fascinating to me is that when we moved from Ananda Village and started here, it came out just the same. And of course, it doesn't look the same, but the vibration came out just the same. The methods came out just the same. The flow came out just the same. I didn't know that it would. But it's sort of like it had to. It was the only flavor in the tube, you know, it just kind of came out like that. But I think it was an astral world memory. And we do it in kind of an astral way. We kind of sense it. We kind of visualize it. We just kind of feel it. And then we apply will more than anything else. We don't have business plans. We don't have that much system. We just apply will to it until it manifests. Is that fair? Is that true? So we're not so far away from the outer world. It's just that everything here takes, look, forever, you know, and it's made of this huge, heavy thing here. This is all this stuff which is taking you forever to get up, all this wood and everything, which is just the underpinning for another huge, heavy piece of wood, is all designed to deliver two lines of illuminated type. I mean, that's all. This whole thing, we're going to do this whole thing, and after it's all done, it won't be anything except two lines of illuminated type, if we're lucky, right? But that's what it takes on this plane. Otherwise, we could just go, you know, and there it would be. We'd all just look at it, we'd enjoy our temple, and then we'd dematerialize it. I remember so seriously. Practically the first day I came to Ananda, somebody said to me, "Well, you know, Swami Kriyananda gets very impatient with things on this plane because he lived in the astral world for so long." It was just one of those things that just has always stayed in my mind. Person said it to me just like that, like they were telling me a little secret, so that now I would know.
Is that true? Does he get impatient?
No, actually, he has more patience than anyone I know. But he does have an expectation that a great deal. What she was really saying, because I also know her temperament, is that he just has an expectation that you can manifest your dream. You have a visualization and you make it happen, which of course now, I mean, that was 30 years ago that was said to me, 31 years ago. So there was a lot of manifesting that was going to happen in between.
It's not that he has less patience, but he needs more.
You said it. Exhibit A. I mean, he needs more. What she was saying is that if he ever appears to run out of patience, it's only because we tax it so much. By the time he's run out, he's spent 500 times more than the average person ever had in the first place. All right. Is there any other questions or comments?
I'm wondering if for people who are unawake, where do the seeds of awakening take place, here or in the astral world?
Where do the seeds of awakening... Oh, they take place... First, you have to... Well, if you're not awake and you can only be aware in the physical world, then obviously the learning has to take place in the physical world because you can't perceive any other reality. I mean, it's very important. The astral world gives us a picture. The vibrations are homogeneous in the astral world, and that's one of the great, lovely things about it, which is one of the reasons that makes us so also uncomfortable here, which is, why do we have to share the planet with, you know, this? Because in the astral world, we don't. In the astral world, we get to just be with our own. That's why the first years of Ananda Village up in Nevada City, first 10, 12 years, when we were very isolated. I mean, we had a meditation retreat, but our advertising was so ineffective. No one hardly ever came, and it was just wonderful. You know, it was just very small. And we were very Indian. We just made a fantasy world, essentially. It was heaven. It was just like being in the astral world. What did you ever want from there? We were very, very primitive, but who cared? I just have this, you know, mental picture of walking barefoot in these little dusty tracks. You felt like you were in some idyllic Indian village. What was the point of that? Oh, but there was nothing. It was just us, you know. It was like an astral world because it was a very homogeneous vibration. There was very little negativity penetrating. You know, one or two people who still are tormenting us, you know, came in and didn't like the game and took all their marbles and went home. You know, just some bad sports were there that are still tormenting us. But mostly it was just one vibration, and it was just like the astral world. Now, let's see. Oh, but the thing is, you can only see what you can see. Not in this chapter, but in other books that I've read about the astral world, which seem true to me. When he talks about how that dark souls can't rise into higher spheres, but lighter souls can come down to help darker spheres. And I heard a description once of just a really dark world where everybody was really self-involved and depressed, and the light beings were right on the edges trying to reach them. And they just didn't know that the light was there. I mean, that's just what it's like now. You know, the light beings are all around us, and when we get depressed and sad, we just don't know that they're there trying to help us. So we have to just go through, we have to go through enough suffering on whatever level we suffer on until we are willing to until it cracks our preconceptions. You know, see, ego is everything. We have this thought, this is the way it is. I know what's true. This is what those people are like. This is what's happened to me. This is the way I can make it work. This is what I have to do. And we have to fail over and over and over and over again in our idea of how it's going to work until we get the humility to wonder what's going on. That is exactly what the story of the bird is in the Festival of Light, is that we're sent out with God's instruction to be expansive, to be fruitful, to multiply, to share with all. But we start getting experiences and we start thinking, no, I don't think that's the right way. I'm just going to, what else is wisdom except to keep what is mine for myself, whether that's my ideas or my money or my whatever. But we hoard in like this. And then it says, nor did wisdom come to him when repeatedly he lost everything he had. I mean, there's just so much, millions of years of anguish in that. And so what happens, I mean, that kind of loss is, you're born, you have all these ideas about how it's going to work out, you're going to have your own little plot of land, and you're going to farm it, you're going to have your little family, and you struggle, 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 and it doesn't work out, and you die disappointed. You know, you lost it all. But then the next time you think, well, I just didn't try hard enough. I didn't have the right wife and all that stuff. And so you try and try and try and try again to do it and repeat and you die again. It didn't make it, you know. Or maybe you die young or whatever, but it just keeps over and over and over until finally just this thought penetrates. Maybe I'm doing something wrong. You know, maybe somehow it's me. And then that's the beginning of the quest. That's the beginning of the thing. Instead of just saying, I know what's right, we say instead, what is going on here? And when a soul evolves, you know, through all the levels of material development to the point where it's lost enough times, it begins to say, what's going on here? And as soon as you begin to ask that question, then perceptions begin to come to you, as soon as you have the humility. And it's the same right now. I mean, we oscillate between the revolt and the quest all the time. You know, sometimes we're genuinely receptive and really want to know, and sometimes we just want to defend our position. Every time we're just defending our position, we're in the revolt, like the little bird, and we're just setting ourselves up to lose everything we have.